We get it. After all the frustration, the endless cycles of hoping for a system that actually works, you're ready for something steady. Something that delivers without constant workarounds or headaches. That's why we're excited to introduce the 2025 redesign of the Buzz CRM. Built with you in mind, it's more intuitive, faster, and smarter than ever. Finally, a CRM that sees your worth, streamlines your workflows, and gives you the tools to thrive without needing to prove yourself over and over again. Because you deserve a lifeline after all those outdated platforms. You deserve a system that keeps up with your goals and grows with your success. This isn't just a redesign, it's a revolution. Visit thebuzzcrm.com today. That's thebuzzcrm.com.
Welcome, everyone. This is Vern Davis. I am the host and your host of Plant Profits. And Plant Profits is an award-winning podcast. Plant Profits is also brought to you by Produce Global and Cannabis Radio. My guest today serves as Director of Cannabis Development for PACESA Strategic Communications, a fully integrated communications agency. And he's on the board of directors of 4Front Ventures, and at one time was president of that, integral in its start, which that's a publicly traded investment and operations company. But as director of the cannabis development for KCSA, Strategic Communications, our expert brings over two decades of experience to the forefront of the rapidly evolving cannabis industry, and that's what we're going to talk about today. In addition to sharing the cannabis practice at KCSA, he wears the hat of CEO at Craneworth Enterprises, where they passionately consult small businesses within the cannabis realm. So there's a lot going on, and I want you all to welcome Mr. Chris Crane, who's the Director of Cannabis Development at KCSA Strategic Communications. How are you, Chris?
I'm great this morning. Thanks for having me on today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad you're here. Excited to have this conversation with you. And I don't want to kind of understand your journey. How did you get to this cannabis thing? You've done a tremendous amount of work and finance and other things. And how did you get to this cannabis journey?
Sure. So I've actually spent my entire career in it.
Yeah.
I started as a campus activist back in the mid-90s at American University, originally with the American University chapter of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. I became a founding member of an organization called Students for Sensible Drug Policy, SSDP, when we started that organization back in 1998. I parlayed that into an internship at NORML my senior year of college, and wound up working there for 6 years in D.C., working on marijuana policy for NORML, ended up becoming the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, where I served for 4 years, also in D.C. And so I spent really the first half of my career working solely on the policy side of this issue, and that led me into the industry in 2009, thanks to a relationship I had with Steve D'Angelo and Harborside Health Center. I was basically recruited to move out there and help start a new consulting company, and that was sort of an offshoot of Harborside that led to, you know, a couple of years later starting 4Front, and you know, the rest is history.
You really got yourself involved into the social justice part of cannabis and that environment, and you've made statements and you've had conversations about the lack of banking and institutional funding is critical in the success or the lack of success that we see in some of these markets and social justice, cannabis ownership. And how have you embedded yourself into that?
Well, remember, I came from the policy side of this issue.
Right.
And part of my motivation in getting involved in that in the first place was looking at the injustices of the war on drugs and cannabis prohibition, the way that Black and brown communities were targeted disproportionately when it came to marijuana arrests and conviction, cannabis arrests, cannabis convictions. So it's always been something that I've thought a lot about and worked on. And so as I've been involved on the business and the industry side of things, you know, I think it's really important. And I've always supported the goal that the communities that were most heavily impacted by prohibition deserve to have an opportunity to participate in this emerging industry. Mm-hmm. And I still think that's incredibly important. It's heartening that so many states have implemented social equity programs, tried to do their best to put licenses in the hands of folks who have been impacted by cannabis prohibition. But, you know, to date, very few, if any, have really been successful because, yes. you know, it's not that difficult to get a license or grant a license to somebody who's been impacted by prohibition. It's very difficult to set them up for success, in particular, to get the funding that they need in order to actually start up their business and compete in a more competitive marketplace. That's been the really challenging part. And that's where it ties into banking and why I think, you know, think making banking and traditional banking and lending available to the space is absolutely critical to ensuring the success of social equity programs.
You made a statement I wanted to get to a little bit. It's been not very successful in many cases. The money's always the root of that problem.
Almost always, that's right.
Yeah. Money is the common denominator. So what, or lack of, right? So, but going into it, what is missing from education about what it takes to actually get it off the road and be successful? And, you know, what I'm asking really is, why so many people taking the same failed journey?
Well, it's challenging because, you know, there's only so much states can really do on the funding side of things, right? I mean, states generally don't have the budget to make hundreds of millions of dollars available to aspiring cannabis entrepreneurs to ensure that they actually have the money to get up and running. And so, you know, most of the states, I think and I'm very quite confident that they have been genuine in their desire to get these social equity programs running and off the ground and have them be successful. And the easiest way for them to do that is to put a licensing program in place that ensures that licenses go to the people that deserve them. They haven't been able to figure out how to make sure these folks get funded. And I think there's been a lack of understanding in general. And I don't think this is just at the state level. I think this is like anybody who's not deeply involved in the cannabis industry at just how challenging it is for folks to raise capital in an industry where it's still federally illegal, right? Where you've got 280E, where margins are being squeezed, right? This is not easy. And I think there's a misconception out there that, you know, having a license to run a cannabis business is effectively, you know, a license to print money, and, you know, this stuff is going to sell itself. And this is, you know, I don't think people realize how difficult this is from a capital and an operation standpoint. And if you don't have the capital available for these equity licensees to get up and running, not just get up and running, but to operate and to compete, you're kind of dooming them to failure. And what we wind up seeing in many cases is folks win a license, and then they turn around and they flip it. They sell it to somebody who actually has the capital, you know, and wants to operate it. And, you know, I've seen states that have said, well, we should just, and there's been conversations about, well, we should, you know, prevent somebody from selling the license if they win it. But it's like, how can you say that, you know, African-American licensee from a disadvantaged community who's gotten a license has to go out and compete in a difficult marketplace where they may not be able to raise capital? Whereas the non-equity licensee, if they go out and want a license, they're perfectly allowed to go out and flip the license and capitalize on it right away, right? You can't do that. You got to be able to find a way to set these folks up for success, and that starts with making, you know, capital more available to equity licensees.
Very hard to do, right? They're very difficult to do. So if I buy a social equity license, can I flip it to anyone?
It depends on the state. In most cases, yes, you can.
But that creates a predatory environment, doesn't it?
It can. I would actually say if they were limited to selling their licenses only to other equity licensees, that would probably create an even more predatory environment, because you're significantly reducing the buyer pool, meaning that they're going to get lower pricing. I'll give you a good example here, right? I live in Illinois, and I've actually worked with equity licensees to help them sell their licenses when they've made the decision to do that. The calculus that someone would go through, and this was a couple of years ago, a retail license in Illinois was selling for about call it $4 to $5 million, right? Now they're selling more like 2.5, right? The market conditions are a little bit different. But particularly when those licenses were selling for, let's call it $4 million, right? We talk to folks and say, look, play this out. So in order to raise the money to get this up and running, you're likely going to have to take on fairly expensive capital, either at really high debt rates, or more likely you're going to get diluted down to about a 50% ownership, right? To raise the money to get operational. Okay, so now you own 50% of your company. Now you got to go out and you've got to do the work. You've got to get it open. You've got to compete in the marketplace with GTI and Cresco and Curaleaf and Forefront and Verano and, you know, everybody, right? All these really experienced operators, most of whom are vertically integrated, right? So they've got bigger margins than you do and can probably do lower pricing. And let's say you do this and you're fairly successful. In licenses in a mature adult use recreational market typically sell for about 1x revenue. So let's say you're fairly successful and you can get this thing to be an $8 million a year store, which is a pretty good store.
A good store.
Yeah, in a marketplace with 500 or so stores. So you're fairly successful. You get this. It's an $8 million store. 3 years from now, you decide to sell your $8 million store. You've been diluted down to 50% to raise the capital. You sell it for $8 million. Your take home on that is going to be $4 million, right?
That's what you're paying for. Yeah.
And $4 million, right? But you've had to spend years worth of work to get there. Lots of headache, lots of heartache. Potentially had to raise more capital, get diluted down. Maybe you're not as successful as you think you're going to be, and it doesn't quite get to $8 million. But if you do, right, you get it to an $8 million store, you're going to sell it for $8 million. Your take home is going to be $4 million. If you sell it today without going through all that work and all that headache, your take home, $4 million, right? Yeah. Why would somebody want to take that risk? And right, to potentially... Yeah. Like maybe they're going to knock it out of the park and they're going to have a $20 million a year store, in which case their take home is $10 million. If you really think you can do that in this marketplace as an inexperienced operator competing with all of these big, well-capitalized MSOs, I always tell folks, go for it. Do it. Like, follow your dream and I will try and help you raise the capital to do it. It's very difficult to do. Right. But if you think your best case scenario is you're going to be at an average or a little bit better than average store in this marketplace, financially, you're better off selling now than you are going down that road and going through the years of headache and heartache and a competition and everything else.
Got it. That's fascinating, Chris. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Vern Davis. I am your host of Plant Profits, and Plant Profits is brought to you by Produce Global. My guest today is Mr. Chris Crane. He's the Director of Cannabis Development at KCSA. And he's also Board of Directors at Forefront Ventures. Chris, we'll be right back.
Plant Profits will return so our sponsors can profit from these messages.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to Plant Profits, and I'm your host, Vern Davis. My guest today, Mr. Chris Crane, Director of Cannabis Development at KCSA, and the Board of Director Member at Forefront Ventures. Look, Chris, as we're talking, what you said to me, that the light bulb went off, and man, I may want to buy and flip these things. Why do I want to be a retailer?
Nobody really makes money running a cannabis company. People make money selling their cannabis company.
Exactly. So you can make it in or out. At some point, you got to sell it. It depends on what you really, really, really want to do. Exactly. So tell me, we were talking about money, which is really important in what you do and having success with these businesses, these small businesses. 280E, right?
Sure.
Big issue when it comes to running a business of cannabis business in this particular case.
Probably the biggest, yeah.
Right. It's huge. So some states are trying to ease the pressure of what 280E means to the cannabis operator. Tell me about that.
I believe New York did it yesterday.
The Northeast is very big on it.
They did the same thing here in Illinois.
So tell me, what does that look like? What does the state do? And tell me the effect on the operator.
I mean, I don't think I need to go through what 280E is, right? This audience is familiar with that. But most states tie their tax codes to the federal tax code. Now, not in all cases, right? The tax rates are going to be different, but the way that you can take your deductions as a business or as an individual, but particularly in this case, right, we're talking about as a business,
right,
is generally the same at the state level as it is at the federal level. And so 280E, right, where you're not allowed to deduct standard business deductions from your taxes, impacts not only your federal taxes, but your state taxes in most mm-hmm. cases, right? And so, and that basically eats away your entire margin, right? You can't, like, it's virtually impossible to turn a profit in most cannabis businesses, especially in cannabis retail, because 280E just crushes your profit margins. And that's at both the federal and the state level. And so what's starting to happen is a handful of states, like I said, New York, they just sent their bill to the governor, I believe, yesterday. Illinois did the same thing earlier this year. A number of other states have done it as well. Massachusetts last year. And so what they're basically saying is that 280E is not going to apply at the state level. So at the state level, you're paying business taxes the way any other business pays taxes, right? Not like cannabis businesses, which are treated illegally. You still have a tremendous tax burden at the federal level, but it does provide really meaningful tax relief at the state level, being treated like a regular business.
That's right. What is that meaning to a business of making money and not making money, as you've seen it for a year, almost a year in Illinois?
Well, I mean, Illinois, it just happened, actually. So, but you know, we've seen it around the country. We've seen it certainly in Massachusetts. I know, you know, yeah. Forefront has operations in Massachusetts, and it's the difference between being able to be profitable and not. Now, when you still factor in federal 280E taxes, there's still not a whole lot of profit margin left. But when you add state 280E taxes on top of that, all that margin is gone.
Yeah.
So look at these top line numbers. I talk to people outside of the cannabis space who are like, oh, look at all these numbers. All these companies are doing. There's so much money in cannabis. Like, yeah, but it's all being eaten up in taxes. Right. I mean, you sound like a Republican here in like, you know, taxes are too high. Well, this is different, right? We're not taxed like every other business. We're taxed.
Well, it's totally different. Yeah.
Yeah. We're taxed like a drug dealer, right? We're quite literally taxed like drug dealers.
You're illegal, but send me your taxes.
Right. I mean, that's literally what he is.
Yeah.
Right? It was put in place to prevent drug traffickers from like writing off their speedboats and say, well, we, you know, use these to run cocaine in from the Caribbean right into Miami. So it's a business expense. Not that was really happening, but this was during like the height of drug war hysteria in the 1980s. And people were bringing up all these like crazy examples of things that like theoretically could happen that just were not in practice. And so we're treated quite literally as drug traffickers under federal law with the intent, you know, the express intent of not letting us turn a profit.
Yeah. So thank you for that. At KCSA, right, and you guys in the communication, what strategies are you guys employing to help your clients navigate this regulatory environment?
So, you know, KCSA we're a public relations firm, right? So what we do is we work with our clients to help them craft their messaging, right, around issues like this, but any other issues that they're facing, help them get the word out about their stores. We're kind of an extension in many ways of their marketing arms. We help them gain earned media to, you know, get quoted in you know, newspapers and media publications and, you know, local news if they're doing a store opening, right, to help them get, you know, to get coverage in their, you know, local papers or local business journals, local news, right, if they're trying to establish themselves as a thought leader, to get them in those types of publications. So for when I was the president of Forefront, I was a client at KCSA for 5.5 years. I've been writing a column on the cannabis industry for Forbes for about 6 years now. KCSA got me that column, right? And so I was really thrilled to be able to join the team after I left Forefront because I had worked with them for 5 years as a client. I knew these folks well. I knew how much they cared about this industry, but most importantly, like what a good job they do for their clients in helping them raise awareness, raise their public profile, and to support their business objectives through targeted public relations and earned media.
Mm-hmm. How has that business evolved in the cannabis arena, the PR business?
Well, you know, I think, you know, KCSA was really the first mm-hmm. major PR firm to get into cannabis. So KCSA is not a cannabis PR firm. And there are some of those out there, and some of them are quite good. But KCSA is a 50-year-old firm. Cannabis and psychedelics make up about 20% of our business. And we're in like really traditional industries like, you know, fintech and agtech and, you know, financial services and, you know, healthcare, right? So, you know, it's large companies and, you know, large established companies and large established industries. You know, I give a whole lot of credit to Lewis Goldberg, the managing partner at KCSA and, you know, personal friend, you know, Ann Donahoe and Phil Carlson, right, who head up the cannabis practice on the PR and IR side, for having the foresight, you know, 7 or 8 or so years ago when they got into this. You know, they were told by other PR firms in New York, you'll never sign another mainstream client again if you do this, right? Like, this is, you know, this is too risky. It's federally illegal. What are you doing? They had to do some, you know, minor damage control, right? Just to reassure existing clients from, you know, major established industries that, like, this isn't going to hurt their reputation, right, because their PR firm is working in cannabis. And they took a real risk, you know, in part because they saw the business opportunity, but in part because they really believe in the issue. They believe in the cause, and they believe that a successful, professional, well-regulated industry is critical to helping end prohibition. So this was the kind of team that I was really excited to be a part of when I had the opportunity to do so.
No, it's great. It's wonderful that you had the relationship already and you knew the entity and you know what the opportunity really was because you've been on the other side of it. So I think that's great. We're going to take a quick break. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, Chris. And when we get back, talk more about KCSA. I want to really get into where you guys are headed in the industry and what are some of the things that you see in your vision about the industry that needs more light shown on it. So I'm Bern Davis. I'm your host of Plant Profits, and you're enjoying listening to the Plant Profits podcast. And my guest today is Mr. Chris Brain, who's the director of cannabis development at KCSA.
Plant Profits will return so our sponsors can profit from these messages.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to Plant Profits. Plant Profits is brought to you by Protus Global. I'm Vern Davis. I am your host, and my guest today is Mr. Chris Frayne, who is part of KCSA Strategic Communications Business. He's the Director of Cannabis Development, and we're having a really cool conversation about PR in cannabis. And so, Chris, take me down the road a little bit. How do you see this going? You're in the weeds. You're in it every day. But when you step back and you just look at it, where do you want to take this with KCSA?
I would love KCSA to be seen as, and I think we're well on the way, the, you know, the premier public relations and investor relations agency for the cannabis industry, right? To represent, I think, you know, both the large publicly traded multi-state operator types, as well as, you know, some, you know, smaller, you know, companies that are doing, I think, unique and interesting things in the space that, you know, that I find really exciting. But, you know, I think when people think of KCSA, I would like them to think of, yeah, that's, you know, this is the premier agency for public relations and investor relations in the cannabis space.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's really helping to raise the profile of the industry as a whole, mm-hmm. to set the stage for what professionalism looks like, you know, and how folks conduct themselves when dealing with, you know, with the media and public relations.
That's very good. So when I talk to folks in our industry, right, and we talk about how's it going and what's happening in your business and those kinds of things, and I get this comment that, man, it's a weird year.
It's been a weird year.
Let's talk about that for a second. You can see weird is kind of easy to say, but when I think of weird, that means something I didn't expect. Okay. Now, I kind of expected what happened this year to happen. And I don't know if weird's the right word. What's your perspective on that?
Well, look, I think to be fair, like every year in Canada, yeah, it's a weird year. We work in a weird industry. It's a weird business, right? I mean, how many other industries are out there that are, you know, completely federally illegal but regulated at the state level, but there's a completely different set of rules in every state that you operate in? You can't ship anything across state lines. Like, it's this industry's crazy, man. Like, it's not for the faint of heart, right? For people who think, like, I've been successful in business before, this is going to be easy. It's not, right? There are all number of challenges here. You know, this year in particular, I don't know if it's been especially weird or crazy compared to other years. Like I said, they kind of all are. Yeah. But it does feel like, at least sort of on the, you know, on the policy side of things, we're on the precipice of something big.
Yeah. Right?
You know, the HHS announcement was a really big deal. You know, rescheduling or deschedule. I mean, descheduling would be great, but, you know, that didn't seem to be like it's going to happen here. Rescheduling would be an absolute game changer for this industry. you know, safer banking or safe banking, right, is continues to, you know, I mean, that's, it's kind of like Lucy in the football, right? Every year it looks like we got a chance and every year we fall on our face. But, you know, we just feel like we're getting closer to the precipice of something really changing. At the same time, it's been a tremendously challenging year from a financial standpoint.
Oh,
right. I don't think I've seen a worse capital environment in cannabis since the early days, right before recreational even passed, or like the early medical days. The, you know, the interest rates that companies are borrowing money at, it's astronomical, and it's going to wind up killing a lot of these businesses if, you know, if more professional capital doesn't enter the space and folks get a chance to refinance, which I do think will ultimately happen. But, you know, the businesses are in as bad a position as I've seen them. We've seen, you know, the combination of capital just largely drying up. There's virtually no equity capital out there. The debt that's out there is tremendously expensive. It would be largely considered serious. Yeah, it'd be considered serious in any other industry.
A little bit.
You know, coupled with the fact that pricing has gone down just about everywhere, which is great for the consumers, but squeezing margins that are already compressed because of our previous conversation with 280E,
right,
and all the other business challenges. Like, this has just been, I think, the most difficult year from a business perspective for the cannabis industry on record, so that I can remember. And yet at the same time, there's this reason for cautious optimism that things may change in the, you know, near to medium future. So, you know, I mean, those two things together, I think, kind of, you know, do make it kind of a, you know, come back to the original question, kind of a weird year.
I can buy part of that being weird, because I think you answered the question when you said, Chris, when you said every year is crazy, right?
Yeah, so, that's true. It's a crazy industry.
Next, here's what you and I know. Next year is going to be crazy. We don't know how crazy, you know, which way crazy, but it's going to be crazy, you know.
Hopefully it'll be crazy, because like stock prices have gone up 10x and all this new lending at 8% is flowing into the space, and you know 280E has gone away because of rescheduling. That's the kind of crazy I'm hoping for, and I think the industry could desperately use right now.
Two questions. What's your bet on two things? The farm bill, HD9 will continue. You know, Hemp Delta 9 will be able to continue because the beverage community is really expanding through that vehicle and doing some really cool things and putting product on the lips of consumers in ways that they could have not done it without it. What is your thought on the hemp bill?
Yeah, to be honest, that's one I have not been nearly as involved in as some of the other stuff going on at the federal level. That said, I do think it is really important that the federal government get a handle on what's going on with these sort of Delta products, Delta THC products in general. You've got the situation now where these legal regulated companies have to jump through unbelievable regulatory hoops and challenges, right? The security requirements in order to operate retail dispensaries are you know, just crazy. We're treated like, you know, banks. And yet now you can walk into like a bodega or a convenience store or a gas station and buy hemp-derived Delta 9 you know, products right behind the counter. Right, with no security, none of this crazy regulatory overhead. That
what is wrong with that, Chris? Why is that?
Nothing.
Wrong?
Nothing is wrong with. Nothing is inherently wrong with that. But if they're able to do that, the legal regulated industry should be too. That's the problem, right? All of these companies have gotten up and running in these legal regulated, state regulated industries where they are treated like banks, like you're dealing in plutonium in some ways, right? And have all of this super high regulatory overhead and 280E.
Right.
Banking challenges and all this stuff, and now all of a sudden they have to compete with companies that don't have to do any of that and can just, you know, and can just sell it straight over the counter. So look, my suggestion would be these state regulated industries should really ease up and, you know, make it easier for operators, because there's really no need for these crazy regulatory environments that we have and these costs. But as it is, like Delta 8, even Delta 9 hemp derived products are, I mean, they're contributing to the major financial challenges that the cannabis industry faces right now, because they don't have those same restrictions. So I think what I'd like to see is a level playing field. That doesn't necessarily mean going at, like, I'm not one who's saying everyone, you know, the feds need to just go after these hemp-derived businesses, but they do need to level the playing field, because they're killing the legal industry, and all these companies have done, you know, all they've done is follow the rules.
Here's the opportunities for those companies who have products only in dispensaries. they should develop the hip version and get more points of distribution on the same brand and build a brand. They
need some are doing that, but state
regulators... They are doing it.
But many state regulators really frown at the idea, right? And so there's a balancing act there of not pissing off your state regulators, right? Who are overseeing this business that you've invested millions of dollars to get up and running. So it's a real challenge. I mean, it needs to be solved. I'm with you. I don't know exactly what the answer is. It is a real problem for the legal regulated businesses that have had to jump through all these hoops and followed all these rules, and now all of a sudden they're competing naked down the block that didn't have to do any of that, and the state seemed to have no problem with it.
Because it
came from hemp instead of from cannabis, which is the same plant.
Yeah, no, totally understand what you're saying. It's just that what I'm actually seeing is those folks are doing both. You know, they're doing.
I don't think a lot of them are really doing both. Most are doing one or the other.
Well, no, it's a movement toward doing both. I see more people
getting into it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's just moving, going both ways, man. I really appreciate you showing up today and being on our show at Plant Profits, Chris. And I want everybody to know that we had a great discussion. I want people to go out and listen to the podcast, right? You can get Plant Profits anywhere you get your podcast. Subscribe, do that, and Approach Global, my company. We're on all platforms of social media. And check us out and see how we are changing lives and building companies at the same time. And protisglobal.com, protisglobal.com. My guest today on Plant Profits, Mr. Chris Crane, is Director of Cannabis Development at KCSA. And Chris, thank you again for being on the show. Until next time, this is Byrne Davis, your host of Plant Profits. Cheers.
We get it. After all the frustration, the endless cycles of hoping for a system that actually works, you're ready for something steady. Something that delivers without constant workarounds or headaches. That's why we're excited to introduce the 2025 redesign of the Buzz CRM. Built with you in mind, it's more intuitive, faster, and smarter than ever. Finally, a CRM that sees your worth, streamlines your workflows, and gives you the tools to thrive without needing to prove yourself over and over again. Because you deserve a lifeline after all those outdated platforms. You deserve a system that keeps up with your goals and grows with your success. This isn't just a redesign, it's a revolution. Visit thebuzzcrm.com today. That's thebuzzcrm.com.